The Burden of Proof, written by Scott Turow and read by Robert G. Slade. Our decisions have respected the private realm of family life, which the state cannot enter. Prince v. Massachusetts, 321 U.S. 158-166, 1944, an opinion of the United States Supreme Court. I once undertook to improve the marriage relations of a very intelligent man. He continually occupied himself with the thought of separation, which he repeatedly rejected because he dearly loved his two small children. One day the man related to me a slight occurrence which had extremely frightened him. He was sporting with the older child, by far his favorite. He tossed it high in the air and repeated this tossing until finally he thrust it so high that its head almost struck the massive gas chandelier. The child became dizzy with fright. The particular facility of this careless movement suggested to me to look upon this accident as a symbolic action. There was indeed a powerful determinant in a memory from the patient's childhood. It referred to the death of a little brother, which the mother laid to the father's negligence, and which led to serious quarrels with threats of separation between the parents. The continued course of my patient's life, as well as the therapeutic success, confirmed my analysis. Sigmund Freud, The Psychopathology of Everyday Life. Part 1. Chapter 1. They had been married 31 years, and the following spring, full of resolve and a measure of hope, he would marry again. But that day, on a late afternoon near the end of March, Mr. Alejandro Stern had returned home, and with his attaché case and garment bag still in hand, called out somewhat absently from the front entry for Clara, his wife. He was 56 years old, stout and bald, and never particularly good-looking, and he found himself in a mood of intense preoccupation. For 2 days he had been in Chicago, that city of rough souls, on behalf of his most difficult client. Dixon Hartnell was callous, self-centered, and generally scornful of his lawyer's advice. Worst of all, representing him was a permanent engagement. Dixon was Stern's brother-in-law, married to Sylvia, his sister, Stern's sole living immediate relation and the enduring object of his affections. For Dixon, of course, his feelings were hardly as pure. In the early years, when Stern's practice amounted to little more than the decorous hustling of clients in the hallways of the misdemeanor courts, serving Dixon's unpredictable needs had paid Stern's rent. Now it was one of those imponderable duties, darkly rooted in the hard soil of Stern's own sense of filial and professional obligation. It was also steady work. The proprietor of a vast commodity futures trading empire, a brokerage house he had named in youth Maison Dixon, and a series of interlocked subsidiaries, all called MD this and that, Dixon was routinely in trouble. Exchange officials, federal regulators, the IRS, they'd all had Dixon's number for years. Stern stood up for him in these scrapes. But the present order of business was of greater concern. A federal grand jury sitting here in Kendall County had been issuing subpoenas out of town to select MD clients. Word of these subpoenas, served by the usual grim-faced minions of the FBI, had been trailing back to MD for a week now, and Stern, at the conclusion of his most recent trial, had flown at once to Chicago to meet privately with the attorneys representing two of these customers and to review the records the government required from them. The lawyers reported that the assistant United States attorney assigned to the matter, a young woman named Klonsky, declined to say precisely who was under